Well, thank you all for coming. Thank you, thank you.
You're so welcome, and indeed welcome back, because you filmed Long Day's Journey in tonight here all around Wicklow. It's been a long time getting here, but maybe as it is the movie that has brought you here, we might begin, Jessica, by talking a little bit about it. Can I ask you firstly about this role you adore, Mary Tyrone? What is it about her?
Of all the characters I've played over, I hate to admit it, 40 years now that I've been doing this, Mary Tyrone is by far the one that touches me most deeply. I've done it on, as you said, on three different occasions. I did a run on the West End, I did a run on Broadway with it, and then we filmed it. And it's one of these astonishing characters, I think, that you could do. I mean, I think about this sometimes. I think, well, maybe I should do it again. Maybe I could find another venue, another place to do this, because you never come to the end of this play, and you never come to the end of this character. She's like a bottomless well, no matter how many times you do it. And I've played her hundreds of times now. You never exhaust the possibilities. And I think that's so rare for an actor to find something like this. And I love her.
What about transitioning, though, from stage to screen with her? What is the difference? Tell us about the craft as such of not having the audience and playing to the camera. Does it mean you bring your performance down a bit, or what difference does it make?
Well, I mean, obviously, doing a film of it is very different. I mean, when we did the play, it's a four-hour play. And to do it, every night, it begins to just kind of live in the marrow of your bones. It lives inside you so completely that you never really let go of it. So when we came back to it years later to do this film, and of course we had a film script of the play, I used to drive Jonathan Kent, our director, crazy, because I'd say, yeah, but the play, and it was like, it was so hard to even let go of like one line or two lines or a moment here and a moment there. But I think the adaptation that we did was really wonderful. And hopefully, I mean, we'll see. This is the first time it's going to be seen by an audience. But I forgot what your question was.
Yeah, just about the difference between playing Mary Tyrone to an audience and to a camera. What is the difference?
Well, obviously, when you're on stage, you know, you're there with the other actors. But then the other entity in the room is the audience. So you're always aware of the audience, and you get this kind of immediate feedback from the audience. You hear them laugh, not so much in this play, but you hear, you know, sometimes you hear people crying in the audience. You hear it's a wonderful exchange. It's almost like having another character that you're working with. And the idea that every night you go out there and you kind of leap into the unknown is what's, I mean, for me, the most thrilling part of theater. But on screen, you know, it becomes more intimate in a way. It becomes, it's that thing with film that I've always been fascinated by, which is this kind of seduction that you have with the camera. And in the old days, it was great, because before video playback and all of that, Video Village, the director would be standing like right next to the camera. And so you would have this sense that this was an exchange between, you were trying to, like, you had this relationship with the camera, with the director, with the cinematographer. It was just a wonderful kind of sensual, in a way, exchange. And so when you're doing it, obviously, Mary Tyrone for the camera, It's a whole different chemistry.
So you're bringing it down from 4 hours to just under two. Interesting, you also, I know your director Jonathan Kent is here, but he directed you on Broadway. Did it help then, I'm sure, that he's directing the screen version too?
Well, of course, because, you know, we were very used to working with one another. And, I mean, I understood Jonathan, he understood. I mean, it was just a very easy, an easy way for me to do it on film.
I'm wondering as well, I'm thinking of the likes of Angela Lansbury, who played Mame and Gypsy on Broadway, but didn't get cast in the Hollywood movie, you know? And I remember her saying that she was so sorry her performance wasn't captured. Does that feel good for you, Jessica, that people can now see you as Mary Tyrone and it's captured?
Well, it's something I always wanted to do, and it's something Jonathan and I talked about very early on of filming it. Because, yes, it's wonderful to have a record of it. I mean, you've got, you know, the at Lincoln Center at the Library for Performing Arts, they have a record of it on. But this is different. So, yes, I mean, it was exciting to do this as a film.
And you're playing it alongside Ed Harris, who is here. And, of course, you're reuniting after starring in Sweet Dreams together.
Yeah.
That must have been great.
It's been wonderful. I mean, Ed was... When I heard that he had agreed to do it, I was absolutely thrilled. You know, we did Sweet Dreams. We were trying to figure this out, like 40 years ago. So, you know, Act One, then we missed Act Two, and now we're in Act Three. And
yeah.
But yeah, Ed's just an amazing actor and so, so exciting to work with, as were the other two actors in this with us.
I'm thinking of the Irish actors you've worked opposite, because you're opposite Gabriel Byrne in this play on Broadway.
Right.
Then we've Liam Neeson. You've played with him in Rob Roy and Marlowe, and then more recently you were kissing Pierce Brosnan in the Great Lily Hall.
I know,
aren't they lucky, Jessica, all of them?
Well, what can you say about Irish men?
Are you comfortable watching yourself on screen, as a matter of interest?
most of the time I don't, but I'm going to watch the film tonight because none of us have really seen it in an audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the first time it's going to be screened, and I'm very curious just to see how it holds, how it plays.
We're looking forward to it. Can I ask you to bring us back to Jessica Lange in around 1970, when you're studying photography and art in the University of Minnesota? You decide, I'm out of here. You hit Europe. And you end up in Paris. Were you just wanting to spread your wings and seeking adventure, or what was going on?
Well, sure, I was 20 years old. I mean, life was, you know, it was, everything was wide open. And, you know, I was with a group of people. We were traveling. We were making documentary films. And then later I moved back to Paris on my own. And it was a wonderful time, you know, to be a young woman living in Paris in the early 1970s. It was, it was the best time.
And you studied mime in Paris.
I did. I studied mime with the great old master, Etienne de Creux, and that was life-changing for me.
So were you thinking of being an actor at that point?
No.
Okay, mm-mm. So when did that hit?
You know, I thought about that a lot. I mean, I think somewhere, even from early childhood, I was already, like, preparing to be an actor. I think in my imagination, because I spent so much of my childhood in my imagination, in these fantasies that I would create and scenes I would make up and characters that would talk to each other and stuff, I realized that somewhere, you know, I was already being drawn completely, you know, unconsciously or whatever. But I came to it because when I left Paris and moved back to New York and had no idea what I was going to do, because obviously mime was not like something you could make a living in. I just started taking acting classes because it seemed like the next kind of step along the way. But it wasn't, I didn't have this drive of being an actor. It was only after taking classes for a while that I thought, oh, yeah, this, it all comes together with this, all of it. I can, I've, you know, the dance, the mime, the photography, the filmmaking, the, you know, the make-believe, the fantasy, it's all part of this piece.
So you're taking acting classes in New York, you're waiting tables, and suddenly you find yourself in Hollywood auditioning for King Kong.
Yep. Yeah, that was very bizarre. I was working at a restaurant in the Village. It was a famous old writer's, a lot of Irishmen there. Very well known at the time, but not chic or anything, just like it was an old Village bar. And I got a call one day from an agency that knew, because somebody had said to me once, why don't you try modeling, make a little bit money? And so I went and saw this woman who had a modeling agency, and I never got a job, but you know, she talked to me and she asked me what I was doing. I said, I'm taking acting classes, working as a waitress at the Lion's Head. And so out of the blue, I got a call one day asking if I would want to fly to Los Angeles and audition for a film. And I thought, oh, gee, I wonder if I have time. It's like, so I said, yes, of course. And they flew me out, and I arrived, you know, and at MGM, which was my favorite studio, even as a little girl. I mean, I knew the MGM logo, the lion, and it was just this kind of weird fantasy come true. I auditioned for it. Well, first of all, they weren't going to audition me because they didn't think I was right for the part, and they didn't like the way I looked, and they weren't interested. But the woman back in New York said, you flew her all the way out there, just run some film on her. Just put her on film, that's all. And then, you know, send her home. So they did. And yeah, that's how it happened.
You got it. Can you remind us of technology back in 1976 in terms of King Kong? I mean, we're talking no CGI. Just how basic was it in terms of what you were playing against as such?
Well, obviously it was on a big green screen, about, you know, at least 75% of what I did in that film was in front of a green screen by myself. Yeah, we had a great big hydraulic hand. I'm lucky that it didn't, like, go haywire and just crush me one day, but I got lucky, I guess. But yeah, there was no CGI, there was no AI, so it was all miniatures and...
But you're thrown into fame so suddenly, Jessica. You know, how was that? Because you won the Golden Globe for Best Newcoming Star. This is a serious big break, so how was it?
It was horrifying. Mm-hmm. It really was. I was, I remember, because we shot basically right up until the time the film came out. I mean, that's how crunched we were in the schedule and how over budget, over schedule. And we wrapped the film. It was coming out like the next week. And on the and I was flying home to Minnesota for Christmas. And I got on the airplane, and somebody was sitting on the airplane with the Time magazine, and the cover in this Time magazine was me in the hand. And I was so absolutely mortified that I went back to my seat and I started to cry. So, yeah. I was embarrassed by the whole thing.
It's interesting where you go from there, because I don't think you know... You knew what you wanted to do, or anyone knew what to do with you in some ways. So your pal Bob Fosse gives you a role in you were in a musical, but you weren't singing or dancing.
No.
Yes.
No. Bless his heart, Bobby was a dear, dear friend. And you know, after King Kong, I wasn't taken seriously, and you know, there were no jobs offered me. I mean, nobody thought of me really as a serious actor. And so there was, I think it was almost 3 years passed between doing that, and then Fosse wrote this part for me.
So that was All That Jazz.
Yeah, in All That Jazz.
How do you go from there to starring opposite Jack Nicholson in The Post Malone Rings Twice?
Yeah, that was a bit of luck. Yep. Yeah, I mean, they just wanted me to do it, so.
Great. How was Jack to work with?
Oh, he's great.
Yeah.
It was great. It was the first real part that I had, you know, and both Rafelson and Nicholson were so incredibly supportive and helpful. Yeah, it was great.
So 82 is a big year for you. I understand the editor from The Postman Always Rings Twice was making a movie and
yeah,
thankfully then saw you as his lead actress.
Yes, he was developing a script to do a film about Frances Farmer, who was a tragic figure in Hollywood in the 30s and 40s. And he offered me this part.
Great. A very harrowing, very heavy role, though, for you. You're not for the first time in your career playing a real person. What was your in for Frances Farmer? How did you capture her in those early days?
Well, the great thing about doing biography is that you have material to draw from, of course. You know, I read her book, I looked at her films, studied her face, her voice, her mannerisms. I mean, it's the same, you know, when you play any, I mean, for instance, you saw a clip of Edith Beale from Grey Gardens. I studied that song that she does, that the Maisel brothers filmed, I mean, day in and day out, so that every note was exactly as she did it. So you have, when you're doing a biography, you do have references that you can use, but then ultimately you ingest as much of that as you can, and then you just have to let it all go. But with Frances, the part was just so extraordinary, and you meet parts at a particular time in your life where it means something. You know, you're meant to coexist. You're meant to live this together. And obviously, that was very true with Frances.
I know you loved playing opposite Kim Stanley as your mother as well. Extraordinary actresses.
Yeah.
Are you drawn, do you think, towards the more troubled women? I mean, we've spoken about Mary Tyrone or Blanche DuBois or Frances here. Are you drawn towards these characters, these troubled women?
I love them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you do them so well.
I do. Yeah. I mean, they touch your heart in a way. And also, I mean, it's like I was saying with Mary, they get inside you.
Coming out of such a dark role, though, I think you needed something lighter. Am I right in thinking that you were advised and urged to do something lighter after that by the likes of Sydney
Well,
Pollack?
I remember Kim Stanley saying to me one day after one of our harrowing scenes together, she was such an amazing person. I mean, I think one of the great actors of all time. And she said to me, "You need to do a comedy next." And I thought, no. And after that, I started getting phone calls from Sydney Pollack, from Dustin Hoffman, just saying, "Would you consider?" And I kept saying, "No, I don't think so. I don't want to do a comedy. It seems so like lightweight." And you know. But anyhow, they talked me into it, and on Kim's advice, I did it, and it was great advice.
What a great movie, everybody! Isn't it? Isn't it just? I think it's one of those films I watch at least once a year. You just kind of need your fix with it or something. It's amazing. We actually have a clip. Maybe we'll take a clip of Jessica Lange and Dustin Hoffman here in Tootsie.
Tell the truth now. Are you sure you're all right?
No.
Why?
Who am I going to have dinner with? Oh, God, I hate myself for being like this. You know something funny?
What?
And I don't want you to take this the wrong way. But since I met you, I'm so grateful to have you as a friend, and yet at the same time, I've never felt lonelier in my whole life. It's as though I want something that I just can't have. You know what I mean? Do you?
Dorothy?
Let me explain.
No, don't. Please, don't say anything.
But there's a reason.
I understand the
reason. No, that reason's not the reason. See, I'm not the person you think I am. Wait a minute now.
Nobody is.
Easy.
Dorothy, it's me.
No, it's me.
I'm just not well adjusted enough. I mean, I'm sure I've got the same impulses. I mean, obviously, I did have the same impulses.
Don't jump to conclusions about that impulse. That impulse is a good impulse, Julie. If you can just see me out of these clothes, I...
No.
What?
No. Oh, my God, that's my father. You've got to tell him.
Tell him. Tell him what? That's a corn cob.
Hello? Hi, Dad. Fine. I'm here with, Dorothy. Oh, no, I can't tonight, Daddy, but wait a second.
Dorothy.
What?
Listen, you've got to see him. I don't care what you tell him.
Just don't lead him on.
Please don't make
Dorothy,
me do that.
Dorothy, please, you got to let him down gently.
I can't.
You owe me that.
I have to tell you a funny story because I was, I have granddaughters, and when they were real little, and they didn't know what I did or anything, but we were up at my house in the country, and I turned on TV, and of course, Tootsie's playing, because it often does, and I sat with them. They were probably only about 4 or 5, something like that, and we sat and watched it, and I was waiting for them to, you know, say, "Ma'am, that's you," or something like that, but they never said a word, just kept watching it. And then finally, I said to them, "Girls, that's me." And it was right after this scene with Dustin in drag and me, and I said, "That's me." And they looked at me and they said, "Which one?" I thought that was perfect.
That's perfect. But it's funny to watch every single time, you know? It hasn't dated at all as a film. Was it as much fun to make as it is for us to watch it?
It was. It was great to make. I mean, I loved working with Dustin, obviously, and with the great Sidney Pollack. I mean, he was just... He was one of those directors, and I've been lucky because I've had a handful or more of them where... Like their kindness and their consideration and their dedication is just so palpable, you know, that it makes you really, yeah, it makes you do your best always. No, the whole thing, I was really glad that I did it after all.
Didn't
obviously.
Sidney Pollack make some beautiful choices too? I mean, I love the end, how it ends with yourself and Dustin
yes.
just going down the street.
Yeah.
It's so gorgeous.
Put our arms around each other
yeah.
and walk away. Yeah.
An Oscar award-winning performance, ladies and gentlemen. Let us come to Sweet Dreams, and we mentioned it earlier where you're playing Patsy Cline, another real-life character.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard you say that you often find the character through the voice. Now,
yeah.
you didn't do the singing for Patsy Cline, but you really got an extraordinary voice. Do you remember how you found that voice?
Well, I went to Nashville quite a bit before we started shooting so that I could work with Patsy's actual producer. He had a studio there still, and he had produced all of Patsy's records. And I would just go there and listen to the music. He'd talk to me about her voice, and then I would start rehearsing, you know, doing the lip sync to it. And he would turn it up so loud that I could like sing at full volume and not be afraid that somebody would be hearing my voice.
Okay.
And there was a thrill to it in a way because the volume was so loud and I was singing full out myself, that there was this strange kind of transfer, so that it actually began to sound like Patsy's voice was coming through me, and it was thrilling. It was just this extraordinary kind of, I don't even know how to describe it, but it was, yeah. So that, you know, getting to Patsy through her voice, well, she had a voice, I mean, as Owen said, you know, it was operatic range. So not like most country western singers at that time, certainly, but she really had this amazing voice.
But another amazing part for you to play, because yes, there was the singing, but it's another harrowing tale. We have a clip here with yourself and your co-star Ed Harris.
Oh, Charlie, let's not call each other names. It don't do no good. We still got to wake up tomorrow and look each other in the face.
Yeah, well, I ain't having no more nights when my wife goes off with another man.
Hey, don't you tell me what you will or will not have. I looked at you tonight and I thought, God help you, Patsy, no matter how hard you try to make things right. Oh, good time, Charlie, just keeps dragging you back down.
Now, don't you whine about me. Where are you when the kids want their oatmeal in the morning? Where are you when Julie pukes in bed at night? You sure as hell ain't here.
Oh, you just lie. You have never changed a diaper in your life between Mama and Madrine and me.
Yeah, the great Ed Harris.
As you say, you're back together and now for Long Day's Journey and tonight, but an extraordinary role to play, Jessica. There is the singing part, but there's the harrowing story as well.
I do remember one thing that Carol Rice, who directed this, the wonderful director, Carol Rice, said in the very beginning, he said, it's not a biography, it's a love story. And I always thought that was such an important element to say to your actors, you know, it is a love story, and it really was. That's how he filmed it, that's how it was played, yeah.
There were a lot of actresses that wanted that role, Meryl Streep included, who kindly said that you did knock it out of the park, which I think we all agree with. Let us come to Blue Sky, winning Best Actress for this incredible role. What strikes me about this is this sort of beautiful free spirit you had to play, because she was so sort of bohemian and free, it got her into trouble. You played opposite Tommy Lee Jones. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, even about reading that script, you so brought her to life, Jessica. How was that for you?
Again, I was working with Tony Richardson, who is an amazing director, and with Tommy Lee Jones. It was such a beautiful script when I read it. There was never any doubt that I wanted to do it. It came at the perfect time in my life. I mean, it's what I was saying earlier, that you feel like you meet these parts when you're meant to. And this really felt that way to me. But then we had a bit of bad luck. The film was shelved for several years because it got caught in this changeover from one studio to another, and it became like, you know, it sat on a shelf in some bank vault for years. Finally, it came out, and the response to it was wonderful, which was, thrilling. But the problem with that was Tony Richardson had died by the time this film finally came out, which was always terribly sad.
Yeah. But congratulations on the Oscar. You must have been thrilled that night to take home the Best Actress.
Yeah, it was exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, come on.
And again, it was one of those parts where she's just on the edge, and I do love those characters. She's sometimes she's in control, most of the time she's not. And it's, I don't know, I've always found it thrilling to play those emotionally unstable characters. It gives you so much to do.
I have to say, when I see the word remake sometimes, I think we all get a little nervous. When it came to Cape Fear, it's one of those ones that worked. Now, I think that's down to you, Nick Nolte, Robert De Niro, a brilliant young Juliette Lewis, and we've Martin Scorsese behind the camera. we've spoken about some of the directors you've worked with. Were you dying to work with Scorsese like most
people? Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had actually gone to see him when he was casting Raging Bull. And I had really, I thought, oh, God, that would be a great part to play. But obviously he cast the perfect person, so.
And you were there with young Juliette Lewis. I mean, I think sort of the scene in that is when Max Cody, and just yourself and Juliette, and you're trying to save your daughter,
yeah,
saying, take me. I mean, that's the scene, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Extraordinary. How was it playing that opposite De Niro?
Well, again, he's one of the great actors that I've had the opportunity to work with. And, I mean, he's just in it, you know.
Yeah.
1,000%, so.
As I said in the introduction, I think you were part of the renaissance of television when big names were going onto the small screen and we were going, what's going on? But you just got these incredible roles, didn't you? And I think a lot of it was down to Ryan Murphy, the producer, writer, and show creator.
Yeah.
He seems to just be a massive fan and just took you under his wing, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, before that, it's interesting because I had hit these kind of doldrums, you know, where I wasn't liking the films that I was doing. I didn't like the parts I was being given. I did things that I probably instinctively knew I shouldn't, but as an actor, you keep thinking, I've got to work. I mean, I have to work. I have, you know, you're not like a writer or a painter or something where you can do this on your own by yourself. You need to be, it's a community, so you have to keep working. You have to keep working. And I took parts, did things that I probably should have never done, but you convince yourself, oh, I can make something of that. I could do something with that part. I can, you know. Or it'll work, I'll make it work somehow. And 90% of the time, they don't. They just don't. Your first instincts are usually right. So there'd been a long stretch where I was just distracted too, because my kids were growing, you know, life had kind of overwhelmed everything. And I got a script to do Grey Gardens. And suddenly it reminded me of what it was about and what I was passionate about, what I loved about acting and making films. And so that changed everything. And then out of that, a couple years later, out of the blue one day, I'm up at my farmhouse, I pick up the phone, and it's Ryan Murphy, who I had no idea who he was, but he started talking to me about a project and this and that, and I thought, well, yeah, why not? Why not try this? I mean, it's something entirely new. Nobody's done stuff like this before. And so I said yes, and I ended up doing the first four seasons of American Horror Story, which were actually quite new and different, and things that had never been seen on television before. We also had like a really great crew of writers who were writing for you, which was wonderful because they knew what you liked to do and they would feed you these scenes and these monologues and these characters. So it all, you know, it all worked out, yeah.
And I mean, we spoke about some of the more harrowing roles you've played. I think you've been having a lot of fun, have you? And with like American Horror Story, has that been?
Well, what was great about American Horror Story too was that it was like a repertory theater. It was the same group of actors. We went from one season to another, but we played different parts, different stories. But you grew to love these people and you spent, you know, 4, 5, 6 months with them and living in, I mean, the last two seasons I did of the four, we shot in New Orleans. So we were all down in New Orleans living this kind of crazy wild life together. And it was, yeah, the experience was quite wonderful.
Quick word just about Feud, Betty and Joan, when you played Joan Crawford. I'm wondering, did you learn anything or what did you learn about her that you didn't know before you played her?
Well, it's interesting because as a little girl, I remember watching old movies on TV with my mother in some, you know, tiny little town in northern Minnesota. And I was always drawn to like the so-called golden age of Hollywood and the actresses, but Crawford never really interested me. She wasn't one of my favorite actresses from back, you know, as a child watching old movies. But then when I started, again, just doing my research and reading about her, she just bowled me over. I mean, she was a survivor of like the nth, I mean, unimaginable what she went through and came out on top. And I mean, it was this extraordinary courage and drive and determination. And so finding all that out about her, I really, yes, I grew to admire her and I loved playing her.
And it's, I mean, Betty versus Joan. As a matter of interest, when you're playing Joan, do you have to be Team Joan? Do you have to be on her side?
It's funny because the crew made up these caps and these tote bags that said Team Betty or Team Joan. So,
can I ask you, looking back at your career, is there one person or a few people you would mention in terms of teachers, actors, directors who've made the most impact and helped you along the way?
Oh, God. I mean, starting from the beginning, I had a great teacher that I worked with. She came out of the actor's studio. Her name was Sandra Seacat. I met her very early on and worked with her for years. Kim Stanley was an enormous influence in my life as an actor. But then everybody we've mentioned here today, all these the great actors, you know, that I've been able to work with, and the directors, but the cinematographers. I mean, on Postman, I worked with Sven Nyquist, you know, and just watching him work and watching the world he created. I do a little bit of photography, so I'm always fascinated by light, and I realize a lot of that comes from the years I worked with these great cinematographers who could create this emotional world just by putting a light here, a light there, creating shadows, doing what it, I mean, so, yeah, it's, I've been really lucky.
I'm wondering, Jessica, as we spoke about you know, starting out in 1976 and being slightly overwhelmed by life at the time, what advice would you give to young Jessica now, looking back?
Oof. Well, I guess I would, a couple things. I would definitely say, you know, again, hearkening back to this idea of staying present, always present, and paying attention, really paying attention to everything, to the relationships, to the work, to the family, to the, you know, sometimes I feel like I went through life in this kind of, I don't know, distracted, I hope that's not true, but sometimes I feel like I wish I could do it again and just pay attention to every single moment. I would also say to young Jessica, don't do those movies you're worried about. Don't do them. Just stay home. Just stay home.
Jessica Lange, it has been such a pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, Jessica Lange.